Well, I retired in June. And Larry has pulled me out of retirement. Not totally retired, semi-retired. Well, I agreed to do this, but I really haven't had time to prepare a Dharma talk. That may sound like an oxymoron, preparing a Dharma talk, but actually quite a lot of thought, practice, work goes into it. And this all happened very suddenly. So I suppose I could have used some notes from an old talk, but that felt like it kind of warmed over something or other. Didn't want to do that. So I thought tonight what we might do is do something more like a satsang. Any of you participate in the satsang with any teacher? We tend not to do them in the Theravada tradition. It's more or less just a straight Q&A. Satsang is when we get a chance to explore together some issues that are on our minds or that have been coming up in practice or in our lives. And it's more of an inquiry than just a question and answer. And inquiry is one of the seven factors of enlightenment, one of the seven mental factors that has to be present for the mind to open. So that means meditation is not just sitting back and watching the show, different thoughts, feelings, sensations pass by with some kind of objective detachment. That's not meditation, that's not mindfulness. Mindfulness has an active inquiry component to it, really wanting to look, really wanting to know what is happening here, what is this about? Who am I? What do I know? What do I know for certain? There's so many questions can stimulate an inquiry. So look, you've all been practicing for some of you probably for a short time, many of you for a long time. Probably different questions have come up for you or different issues. There may be some part of the practice which feels more challenging than others, or something that you always run smack up against when you're sitting or when you're doing practice. Or it may be something that some teacher said that seemed really profound at the time, but it you realize you didn't really get it. I remember one day in Bodhgaya, taking a walk with my teacher out behind the Chinese temple where he was living. And I had gone over there to do my doctoral research for the University of Chicago, but that was really the cover story. It got me the money, it got me over there, but what I really wanted to do was learn to practice and learn Buddhist psychology. And I had a kind of semi-structured interview that I was going to use with different practitioners. And one of the questions, I'm embarrassed now when I think about it, one of the questions I asked Manindraji on that walk was, Manindraji, what is the Dharma? A simple little question like that. What is the Dharma? But you know, he never blinked. He never hesitated, never missed a beat. He said, Dharma is living the life fully. What? Dharma is living the life fully. And it was one of those statements that went in one ear, kind of rattled around in my brain, and came out the other ear without having really been processed. I thought, gee, that sounds profound. I'll have to think about that sometime. And it took me, I would say, 2 or 3 years, long after I was back home, to really begin to grok even a little bit what he was trying to tell me. So maybe there's something like that for you. Someone said something once that stimulated you. Maybe it has something to do with your being on the path, but you'd like to explore it a little bit more, or there's something about it you didn't quite understand. Could be anything. Or could be long-standing grievances with the practice. If you don't have any grievances with the practice, then you're not doing it right. Because it goes counter to our all of our normal ways of thinking, feeling, being. Yeah, so I open the floor. I mean, any of you that want to bring something forward, something from your, could be something from your personal life if you don't mind sharing whatever it is, but that has a, you're working on it or trying to work with it in a practiced way. Anything. Yes. Oh, good.
I have a question about emotions.
Emotions?
Yeah.
That's a dirty word in Vipassana.
I know. So just on a daily runaround, when I notice myself reacting to whatever it might be, it's usually peculiarities in somebody other than myself. And the older I get, the more accepting I find that I am about other people's desires and ways of doing things, etc. So anyway, I pick up pretty quickly that I am reacting emotionally. Let's say it's irritation. It's not usually anger. And I've always wondered about how to, I don't know if that neutralize is quite the right word, but how to, I work on calming my heart down.
Say that again.
I work on calming my heart down and saying things to myself. There's a bit of a let's check that, okay, and do this. And I mean, it doesn't go away by itself without consciously saying, I notice I'm getting upset. Okay, it's not worth getting upset about. So I don't think I'm necessarily doing this in a processed way. I don't know. I don't like the sound of neutralizing something. I mean, I'm trying to be there in the middle. I don't like neutralizing because I don't think living in a completely neutral zone is a terrific thing. It's a real drag, in fact. So I got an argument going there. Can you help me out with that?
Any of that sound familiar?
Yes.
I guess you've got some friends here. Well, there's a very focused question, and then that's part of a much bigger question that you're asking. What do I do with these reactive emotions when they come up? Right? I guess we can hope they won't come up. Of course, they always do. So we're left with a challenge. It goes back to what our basic motivation or basic intention in practice is. What is our basic intention? Is it to get rid of all the stuff that troubles us? No? You saw that coming. What is it? all right, here are these feelings that well up sometimes. They're not always pleasant, but even the pleasant ones can be disturbing because they can sweep us up and take us over before we're aware of it. A woman told me recently that you can't call him a boyfriend yet, this just sort of exploring this. He asked to drive her home. Now, she lives only two blocks away, so clearly he had an agenda. And they stop, they park, and he asks her if he can give her a goodnight kiss, first kiss. And without thinking, she says, sure. And then by the time she was telling me about it, she said, well, you know, it's really funny because on the one hand, I was horrified that I just reacted the way I did without thinking about it. And she has a lot of problems with dating, with relationships. She said, but it felt so good. Do I just get rid of it? Get rid of that good feeling? No, practice, unfortunately, the way it practices sometimes taught, and particularly in the Theravada tradition, more so than any of the other traditions, I think, we have these lists of feelings and emotions that are considered unwholesome. And so the initial reaction is to say, well, how can I get rid of them? How can I neutralize them? First of all, we can't. They're going to come up. And secondly, if we don't learn to work with them, we miss a great opportunity of absorbing their energy, even the energy of anger, and putting that to good use. But if we take the goal of practice to be to get rid of all the bad stuff that we don't, and mostly it's stuff we don't like, we'll cut ourselves some slack on stuff that we like. But it really, it doesn't really matter whether it's stuff we like or stuff we don't like. We're still kind of often pushing away, and we're using mindfulness sometimes to do that. You know, I'm sitting here, I'm watching this flow of thoughts and feelings in my mind, but I'm not really engaged with it. I'm kind of back over here, and it's taking place out here. Of course, until it takes me over, and then that's a different story. But I'm trying to watch it with objectivity out here. But you're not engaging with it, and until you engage with it, you're not going to be able to do anything with it. Like I said, you'll miss a wonderful opportunity. That's partly what Munindraji meant when he said Dharma is living the life fully. It's not deciding that this piece of my life I don't want to have anything to do with, like emotions. And this piece I do want something to do with. He said you've got to live it all. It's our nature to awaken. But that means awakening to everything. Being willing to embrace it all. I don't know, maybe that sounds a little weird. But it's one of the many ways in which practice is counterintuitive. Because we've evolved as mammals to have this fight-flight response, or the freeze response. I either freeze, I flee, or I fight. Those are our three ways of dealing with danger that have evolved over millions of years. And the Dharma comes along and says, you don't do any of those three. You don't flee, you don't fight, you don't freeze. you reach out and you embrace. Yes.
So there's a contradiction.
Just following up on your example, there's I don't understand then the idea of not, of what is engaging with whatever it is that's going on and what is not identifying. Because isn't there teaching about recognizing the rain idea, the recognizing mm-hmm. awareness, but not identifying? I don't understand.
Well, it's a very good question. The not identifying, or trying not to identify, is often what leads us to distance and pull back and not fully engage. Fully engage means, in the case of a feeling, for instance, to give it our full attention, to be fully present to it, to taste all of it. It's the only way we'll know it, and it's the only way we'll ultimately be free of it.
But being free of it would be not getting rid of it.
No. Where to start with that? See, the truth is, I'm not sure we ever totally become free of anything that we're supposed to become free of. Now, when we're somewhere halfway along the path, we don't beat ourselves up so much for that because we say, well, I'm doing the best I can. I got this far. And I'm not expecting that I'm going to get rid of it all. But if you look at the statements of people that presumably have gotten rid of it all, like Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, any of you know him? See, we Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. He's an Indian saint, or was until he died a few years ago. He wrote, or people transcribed a series of his questions and answers with students and put it together in a book called I Am That. If you ever get it, it's the most remarkable book you'll ever read. Yes, he's a Hindu, you know, he's a Vedanta teacher. He's not, and his livelihood, he rolled beedies. You know what beedies are? Beedies are those Indian cigarettes where you put some tobacco in a grape leaf and you roll it up and wrap some string around it. That was his livelihood. His family had a beedie shop. And he was enough of an entrepreneur to expand the beedie shop to 3 beedie shops. And somewhere along the line, he became one of the most deeply realized people in his generation. But someone asked him this question once. Look, you never experience any aversive emotions. Thinking that that's the practice, isn't it? That's the goal. And to the student's astonishment, and to my astonishment at the time, he said, no, those thoughts and feelings and reactions still come up. The difference is, when they come up, they're almost instantly recognized, and then they subside. I don't linger with them. I don't need to. As long as I give them my full attention, right away they subside. And I found similar statements in Adyashanti, the teacher I recommend very, very highly to you. He was trained in the Zen tradition, California, but has kind of gone out on his own. But he's written in some of the most wonderful teachings of the Dharma you'll ever see. And he's on YouTube and he's got his own website, Adyashanti. He's a really extraordinary teacher. He said almost exactly the same thing about his own experience. So when I heard that, I thought, oh, I don't have to get rid of all of these things. And I can't, I don't have to waste my energy in thinking that that's the goal. The goal is to end suffering. How do I end suffering? Well, you can, one way of talking about that is to not identify with things that come up. But that to me is a little bit too intellectual, it's a little bit too cold. And there's often not enough warmth in our practice. We're so busy sort of observing. You know, if you have an obsessive compulsive bent, that's great news to just be able to observe. Because there's no, but what is missing is the life. There's no liveliness in it.
Mm-hmm. So I'm following up still on this, and that is the word you used a little moment ago was the dissolve, and that actually happens to my surprise, which is that I notice that I'm angered or irritated, and just bringing it into consciousness, or I don't know if you say knowing it, or being aware of it, or it's mm-hmm. because it's in your conscience.
Mm-hmm.
It's an observation in yourself, and it does just go away.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. But I just wondered what makes it go away.
Because you're not putting more new energy into the system. You're not feeding it. You feed the horse, and the horse will keep on eating. So we're not putting more energy in. That's really what the difference is. We're not avoiding it. We can get engaged with it, but we're not putting that possessive, grasping energy in that says, you know, I want this, I don't want this, instead of, this is what's happening. That's all. This is just what's happening. Maybe I can give you another example, which I don't know if this is the best example. Well, why not? So, one day, you know, any of you know Dan Brown? Yeah, he's another Buddhist teacher in town. He gives talks every week over at Samadhi. I think he's moved out of town up to Gloucester recently, but anyway, Dan's a very bright, accomplished guy. He's now in the Tibetan tradition. But this was back in graduate school. We were best friends in graduate school and went all through together and really encouraged each other. And this day, Dan was leading a kind of workshop with a few people, myself included. And one of the people started to have a rough time. So he was working with her, and I was sitting over to the side on the floor. And I was wide awake, paying attention. It was probably a few hours into this workshop. And all of a sudden, in front of me was this huge demon, which I found out later because these were early days for me. I knew nothing about Buddhism. I knew nothing about Tantra. I knew nothing about anything. No idea what this being was. I found out later it was Yamantaka, the Tibetan god of death, or the emanation of death. It was frightening. Big, you know, with the fangs and the pools of blood, and it was all there. And My first reaction was to be terrified, of course. But somehow I resolved to, it felt like he was inviting me into some kind of a process, and I resolved to see it through as far as I could. So I'm sitting here, he's standing there, and I looked over and I saw this little pinpoint of light in his heart, little pinprick of light. And as I looked at it, it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and it started to consume him and just fill the whole field around him. And when I looked at my own heart, I saw a similar little pinprick of light. And it too began to expand and expand and expand and get bigger and bigger. And his light enveloped him, my light, light enveloped me, and then the two lights merged, and it was just this one great ball of brilliant white light. And the fear that I had been feeling just began to subside. And it was replaced by an enormous, partly curiosity or inquiry, you know, what is happening here? And partly a great feeling of warmth that began to envelop me. And then the whole process reversed, and his ball of light kind of all came back down into that one pinprick of light in his heart, and mine did the same. It all came down into that pinprick of light in my heart. Except now, there was no fear. There was tremendous joy. And a sense that what had started out as an adversary, this demon, had now become a friend or an ally. And that's the arc of any moment in practice, of starting out scared, or starting out confused, or starting out doubtful, and staying with it, and staying with it, and staying with it, and seeing where it leads, what's that about, and that's where it will take you. Doesn't have to be some damn demon. That's, you know, just my own neurosis. But it's the arc, you know, of how that plays that is important. Now, I didn't identify with him. I don't remember really identifying with anything in the sense that I was saying, that's me. Any more than an individual thought is my thought. It's not my thought.
Whose is it?
Whose is it? Whose is it? Question to you. Whose is it? Does it have to belong to someone? What makes it have to belong to someone? Well, in is a metaphor. It's, you know, it's in me in some, I don't know, some metaphorical sense. But it's not some entity, it's not some thing. So, does it have to belong to anyone?
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Why don't you explore that? Next time you're doing some practice, wait for some thought to come along that's clear enough. And you can engage with it enough. And then, okay. Right, well, we all do. And see if it belongs to anyone. There are different ways of doing that. You could ask, does this feel like my thought? Mm-hmm. Is this my thought? Is this someone else's thought that somehow got into my mind? Mm-hmm. Is this something my mother used to tell me? And it's still there. But is that my thought? Mm-hmm. I think what you'll discover is that, I mean, you see what you discover for yourself. Don't, it may not be what I would discover. It's fine. But it may turn out that it doesn't belong to anyone. And this, and go look for that someone that it might belong to. And see if you find them. Yeah.
So, on that note, I'm an entrepreneur. I own a couple of restaurants.
You're what?
An entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I own a couple of restaurants, and I'm having a hard time, I guess, reconcile some of the principles that we practice with my work. For example, I've been thinking about non-self and the ego and so forth, and you know, seeing things as they are. But many times in my job, it's my job to make things as they are. And if the thoughts that I think become reality, so I feel like if I don't have my ego or have my thoughts, or not my thoughts, but the thoughts, then nothing will get done.
Right, right.
And there's no restaurant.
You'd be out of business by Friday.
Yeah. So, and, you know, I, like everyone else, want to find a way to end my suffering. And my job creates a lot of suffering because it, I think, some way goes against what I'm practicing. So my question is there a way to reconcile the practice with your career or that situation? I mean, do Buddhist principles mix with business principles?
Say again?
Do Buddhist principles, can Buddhist principles live with business principles?
They better be able to, or they're, you know, they're going to become obsolete very quickly. I mean, for 2,000 years, 2,500 years, people have been doing all sorts of things, but they found ways of reconciling or integrating their practice and their principles. So there's a kind of prima facie case for, yes, that can be done, but when you're in the middle of it, it seems very hard to do. It's hard to even imagine what that would look like, because you're running around trying to keep this restaurant going, right?
Yeah.
Well, what you can't do in a restaurant is the kind of practice we do here in the Zendo. You can't be running from place to place doing, because you're multitasking all the time, right? All right, you can't be doing all the multitasking and labeling each thing that you're doing. You know, the way we label thoughts and feelings in mindfulness practice. It's absurd. You drive yourself nuts in a very short period of time. So that's obviously not the way to practice mindfulness and not the way to integrate mindfulness in your practice, in your work. I think the simplest way to integrate the two is to give your attention fully to whatever it is that you're doing at that moment. That's a way of being present, right? It's a way of not getting pulled off center by extraneous thoughts in this kind of whirlwind that you're caught up in. But just giving in a very gentle, appreciative way, that's important too, to appreciate what it is that you have and what it is that you're doing. Be grateful for it. And then give your attention to it fully in a very simple way. That's practice. That's mindfulness. Now, I don't know, maybe you think you're already doing that. You're certainly trying to.
I try to as much as I can.
As much as you can. And the other thing about that's so important about trying to integrate work and life practice is to do it without any judgment. that's terribly hard for all of us. You know, we're always judging ourselves and judging everyone else. If you could do a tape, an audio tape, of your mind, and play it back, what would you hear? What do you think you'd hear? I mean, we'd be appalled, I suppose, or we'd just keel over laughing. But what we would hear is 90% of that tape in our mind is judgments. I want this, I don't want that, why are you doing that, why aren't you doing this? On and on and on and on. And it's the judge. It's letting the judgments be and just giving your attention to what you're doing. That's the other half of it that would make a very big difference. And then just some kindness and compassion toward yourself at this point in your practice and your work life, that you'd like to have this all more together, but the truth is you don't yet. You probably will someday, be my guess. You seem very serious about it.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Yeah, well, be appreciative for where you are. Be grateful that you're on the path, both at work and in practice. Yeah. We're not generally appreciative enough, I think, of what we experience. Yeah.
You talk about being curious. So I was wondering if there's...
Can you speak up a little louder? I can't
yeah,
hear you.
You talk about being curious and inquiry. So I was wondering if, and we talk about unhelpful thought patterns, emotional patterns that we experience, that we find ourselves in. So I was wondering if, rather than pushing them away, we can be disinterested in them. We can notice them and become aware of them and just say, I'm not interested in that.
I am or I'm not.
I'm not.
Or I'm not interested.
Or just be disinterested rather than think I'm disinterested. Just say, okay, that's that. That's that pattern that I know of.
So the question is,
What do you think about that? That sort of type of disinterest.
Well, if I've
the same as pushing away, is it something positive, helpful for the practice, or is it just another form of pushing away, I guess, or judging a situation?
Yeah. Well, you want to be careful, I think, not to see people as an impediment to your practice. You know, in safeguarding or cultivating your own awareness, that shouldn't involve not paying attention to other people.
No, I mean thoughts.
Thoughts. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe here's another way to do it, to come at it. You know the story of Faust? A lot of different authors have written it up in different ways. I think I'm thinking of Goethe's version. Faust enters into this epic struggle with Mephistopheles, the devil, right? Mephistopheles, and he's only the devil from Faust's point of view. And from another point of view, he's not a devil at all. He's actually Faust's teacher. But we'll stick with the basic story. So Mephistopheles wants Faust's soul. And Faust says to him, you can have my soul on one condition, that you bring me something in this whole great phenomenal world that I will say, stay thou moment, thou art so fair. You get what Faust is asking? He's asking Mephistopheles to show him something that's so compelling that he won't want anything else, won't want to go anywhere else. Stay thou moment, thou art so fair. So the bulk of the tale is Mephistopheles bringing out all the goodies of this world. And Faust touches, tastes, feels, appreciates each one. But he can't say to any of them, stay that moment, thou art so fair. Because none of them, when he really inquires and explores it, none of them really satisfies. He still has an emptiness in his heart. Now that paradigm turns up all over the place. In St. Matthew's Gospel, the devil takes Jesus up to the top of the temple. Some of you might remember the story. And he does the same thing. He says to Jesus, if you bow down and worship me, you can have all of this world. I'll give it all to you. And Jesus, in effect, does the same thing. He says, no, it doesn't satisfy. And in the Buddhist, if you remember, right in the moments before the Buddha's enlightenment, what happened? What happened?
Mara.
Mara. What about Mara? What did Mara do? What was Mara trying to do? Yeah, he was trying to deflect the Buddha from his path, right? He was terribly worried that the Buddha actually would get enlightened. So he tried to deflect the Buddha, and how did he deflect him? What did Mara do? He did exactly the same thing that Mephistopheles did and the devil did. He trotted out everything he could think of that might tempt the Buddha, that might pull him off his seat. I mean, he starts with the dancing girls, but they're pretty easy to deal with. And he works all of his way up, to the Buddha being a world conqueror, which was this other possible destiny. But the Buddha can't say that either. There's nothing that Mara can show him that will pull him off his seat. And that's the origin of the famous, earth, the mudra, the earth-pointing mudra, where his right hand is over his right knee and he's pointing to the earth. And he says, in effect, the earth will bear me witness. I have never lost my seat, and I'm not going to lose it now. Be gone, Mara. And he refused to be moved. So we do something very similar in our mindfulness practice. Or that's one way of working with it. Instead of just watching these things go by our line of sight, we could inquire of each one of them. That's too much, each one. Some. Don't need to inquire with each one. Are you it? Hey, that comes from a child's storybook, doesn't it? Are you my mother? Remember that, those of you who've had kids? You my mother? This little bird has fallen out of the nest, and he can't fly yet. His mother's off getting food, and he starts this journey around the barnyard trying to find his mother, and he's asking all these different objects, different things. The last one is a steam shovel. He asks the steam shovel, are you my mother? It's great. It's exactly the way we are. I would never ask a steam shovel. Oh, yes, you would. Under certain conditions, you would. Or you would be delusional about what you were looking at. You wouldn't see a steam shovel. You'd see something else. So what we can do in practice then is ask each experience as it arises, are you it? Are you enough? Do you satisfy me? And really be honest with ourselves about what answer we get back. You asked me, how do we engage with these thoughts and feelings? That's another way of engaging with them. It's not identifying with them, it's just trying to find out the truth. And if they don't satisfy, if you've gone through 1,000 of them in a day or a week or a month, and nothing is satisfied, and you're still doing it, maybe a question begins to arise in your mind. Wait a minute, maybe I'm looking in the wrong place. Maybe these things don't satisfy. What does satisfy me? What fills that hole in my heart? Yeah. Or yet another way, another kind of question you could put to this passing show of phenomena, you could say, what do I want? That sounds like a very un-Buddhist question, doesn't it? What wanting is so, got such a bad reputation in Buddhism. Desire is one of the three poisons. We're not supposed to have any desire. That's nuts. We have this humanity, this human side of us that has to be included. So, what do I really want? What do I really, really want? And put that question again and again and again. Don't try and figure it out. Just put the question and then be silent, be still. Put the question again, be still. The answer is not going to come from our mind. It's going to come from somewhere in our gut. But it will take you to where you want to go. It'll take you to who I really am. What do I want? What do I really want? What do I really, really want? A very powerful question. It cuts through layers of bullshit. If we're sincere about it and honest about it. Yeah.
I feel a little reluctant to ask this because I feel like if you were wanting to...
You feel what?
Reluctant to ask what I'm about to ask, but because I feel like if you were willing to share it, then you might have already said it, so don't feel obligated to say it, but what is that... when you ask yourself that question, what leaves you feeling full inside?
What do I feel inside?
Well, you say like all of these things leave you feeling empty, the dancing girls and the... Like the being the conqueror of the world or whatever, but when you really ask yourself what you really, really want, what is that thing that does not leave you feeling empty, but rather leaves you feeling full in your experience?
So you're asking me personally.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said feel free not to answer it.
No, I'm so glad you did. I mean, more people should do that. You know, one of the great things about studying with Menindra was he was a very traditional Indian teacher. He opened his door at sunrise and closed it at sunset, and during the day anyone was free to just come in and talk with him. That was his teaching. That was the way he taught. He didn't give retreats or formal teaching. And people would ask him things about himself. It's the great thing about Nisargadatta's book. Students ask him any bloody thing, and he answers them. So I remember one student asking him, look, when you're sitting at supper and you're waiting for the meal and the meal is late, do you have the same reactions I have? He'll tell you. I'm glad you asked. More credit to you for not holding back. If I'm honest and I look back over the years, what has responded has been different at different times, what I've wanted. But there's been a thread through all of it. I was a Trappist monk when I was 22. And I don't know if you know anything about the Trappists, but they're a very strict, severe order. They take a perpetual vow of silence for the rest of their life. And they're usually in isolated monasteries. They don't talk with each other. What's a 22-year-old kid doing in a place like that? What was going on in my mind that made me think this was a good idea? But it was a good idea in the sense that it brought me up against some limit that I needed to come up against before I could let it go. I absolutely had to test myself, push myself. Would I do the same thing now? No, not at all. But I had to then go for broke. And that's what you do when you're 22. You know, you're a hero. You're out after big things. Now when I ask that question, I always get back the same answer. And it may not, the words may be different. Sometimes there's no words. It's just a feeling in my gut. The answer is always to awaken. To awaken. I find that a better word than enlightenment. Enlightenment is so charged, and we have so many different images and ideas about it, and they're all wrong because it can't be imagined. But somehow awakening is more vivid. But it's a good practice. You can do it anywhere. You can ask most of these questions and do this kind of inquiry, you know, driving to Starbucks. Even if you ask one question, one time, what do I really want? Before you get to Starbucks. Yes, and maybe that particular morning, because you're going to Starbucks, that's what you most want. And be honest about it. If that's the truth, if that's what you get back from the inquiry, then be honest. That's letting things be as they are. Don't try to kid yourself or kid someone else into being more spiritual than you really are at that moment. Actually, the most spiritual thing you can do is to just acknowledge, yeah, that's what I want, is Jamocha almond fudge. And then it's very interesting to watch what happens after that. And after you've had a few spoonfuls, then what? Yes?
Just to go back, a quick question. Earlier you were mentioning a demon coming up. Can I just ask you what were you doing at that moment? I mean, what kind of practice was it, or what kind of meditation was it that would happen?
It's a good question. To my recollection, I wasn't doing any particular practice at that moment. I was just paying attention to what was going on in the room. Maybe my mind had wandered. I know that this friend was in pretty dire straits in her own self-exploration. And maybe that prompted the image of a demon, that there was something demonic taking possession of her that she wasn't able to deal with and felt overwhelmed by. And maybe part of me said, well, maybe you can help by confronting that demon that she at this moment is not able to. But that wasn't a thought at the time. That's just reading back into what may have been going through my mind. I don't really remember. It was some 45 years ago.
Was it something you've experienced before or after?
Never experienced before. A few times after, but nothing that dramatic. Just kind of fleeting glimpses.
I'm hoping I don't.
If you don't want to, the odds are you won't. Right. But you know, one of the wonderful things about those days, or those couple of years in the mid-70s, was that I knew nothing. I knew a lot about the Christian mystics, and something about Jewish mysticism. I'd studied both history of Christianity and history of Judaism before that time. But about these traditions and this way of looking at the world, I knew zip. That was one of the things that prompted me to begin to study it. But I really had no knowledge. I'd never seen any Tibetan tankas or iconography, so it couldn't have come from there. Did I know what?
Did you know who the demon was at the time?
No, I didn't have a clue. I just knew he, you know, he terrified me in the beginning. It was that arc from terror to joy that was so powerful. But it doesn't have to be that dramatic. We can go through these arcs every day in very small things. And certainly go through them with our children. From fury to love. So, and everything in between, yes.
How can we be non-goal directed in the practice?
How can we become non-goal-directed?
Non-goal-directed.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think there's one simple answer to that. You know, I think we learn how to become non-goal-directed along the way, by following out a lot of blind alleys that didn't lead anywhere. But the goal of practice isn't so much to become non-goal-directed. Goal in the sense of something to grab hold of or something to attain or achieve, yeah, that's not helpful. But we need something to focus and direct our practice. Maybe it's not a goal, the striving for a goal, that kind of striving derails us, but maybe we could think of it as an intention. My intention is to, walk this path to the end. That's not a goal exactly. It's not something I'm striving for. It's just where I'm putting myself. I'm putting myself right here and seeing where this is going to take me. Yeah, there's so much in Buddhist teaching that is very close to. It's like, what are those pairs of opposites? Not opposites, but, this paradigm of near enemies. You know, like pity is the near enemy of compassion. It kind of looks like compassion, but it isn't. Well, that's the thing about goals. They kind of look like something we benefit from, but they don't really, not if we're reaching for them and trying to achieve something. You've heard that from a zillion teachers, I'm sure. Practice is not about achieving anything. Well, why the hell am I doing it then? And the answer to that changes a lot too over time. But obviously you're all here, something that keeps bringing you back. It's great. It's inspiring. Inspiring to me. Yes.
I'm very much in this place that you're talking about. I used to practice years ago a lot.
You used to what?
I used to practice years ago a lot, and yeah. From a different place. I was very inquisitive, and I had a burning desire, and I was looking for answers and so forth. And about 15 or 16 years ago, I pretty much stopped. I had kids, and kind of that took over I'm not sure it was so good that I stopped, but and now I'm coming at it from a totally different place. I'm coming back to it, I think, out of need more than some sort of positive force, and it has to do with confronting this emptiness and this exact question, you know, what do I want? And I find it really difficult to not be repelled almost. I'm drawn in, but I'm also repelled.
To not be what?
To be repelled by having to kind of confront that in that way. I don't find it terribly energizing to be struggling with emptiness. So I guess I'm looking for suggestions about how to maybe look for positive energy in that kind of space.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. That's a difficult thing to put out there, the whole journey of it, and then where you find yourself today. I wouldn't go after the emptiness. I wouldn't focus on that. It's not nourishing. It is way down the road, and or it is any time you can access it, true emptiness, which is, to say, reality. But to work with as an object in practice, it's very difficult. Most traditions don't. I'd switch my focus a little bit. How would I put it? Yeah, Adyashanti has a wonderful little epigram where he says, first we awaken from life, and secondly, we awaken as life. That makes sense? First we awaken from life. That's the transcendent side of practice, where we're kind of moving beyond, or we're beginning to see the dream state as a dream and not identify with the dream that we're creating all the time. But that's only half of the story. The other half is deeply appreciating, knowing and appreciating that we are an expression of life. Now, those are just words, and they're not very, you know, but they point in a certain direction. And that's more nourishing. I'll give you another example. Do any of you know a German shepherd named Strongheart? Ever read anything about Strongheart? He was just prior to Rin Tin Tin.
I know him.
Okay. Any of you have a German shepherd? No? Oh my goodness. Okay. So, friends of this Hollywood script writer gave him this German shepherd to look after for a year while they went to Europe. And the shepherd's name was Strongheart. And he became a great Hollywood movie star. In fact, for the last 3 years of his life, he was the top money earner in Hollywood, beyond Clark Gable, the whole lot. It was Strongheart. It was extraordinary what he could do. But it wasn't even so much what he could do, it was his mind. So the screenwriter said, well, I've got a year. I'm going to devote it to understanding this dog, trying to understand him, because I know there's something really special about him, but I don't know what it is. So I'm going to find out. And so the most of the book is a little, it's a beautiful title. It's called Kinship with All Life. And so the script writer takes the carrying around a pencil and pad of paper with him. And every time he notes something extraordinary that Strongheart has done, he writes it down. Or some extraordinary quality that Strongheart manifested, he writes it down. And there are days and evenings when they go out into the San Bernardino Hills and they just sit there for hours looking out into the universe, saying nothing, not moving. And Strongheart leads them up there. And then he had that presence of mind to let the dog lead him. In fact, the way he describes the turnaround in their relationship was, he said, it started to come alive for me when I was willing to be the student and let him be the teacher. And then what happened was extraordinary. I won't even try to describe it. But it did seem like it was a mind-to-mind connection. And the reason I'm telling the story, the final climax was, in his understanding of the dog, finally he realized, I am not looking at a dog with great qualities. I am looking at great qualities manifesting as a dog. You get the difference? You are manifesting those great qualities. And those great qualities turn out to be what Buddhists call paramitas. Right, the 10 virtues, they're exactly the same that he found in this dog. That's where you can find more nourishment, and it's still Dharma. It's still in the service of waking up from the dream state. His dream state was believing that he was superior to the dog. We've all got some equivalent of that. Often with one another. That never works very well, does it? So this little book was just reissued, republished a year or two ago. It had sat fallow for 30, 40 years, and it's available. You can get it on YouTube. Amazon. It's a beautiful little book. It's pure Dharma, but looking in another area. That's what's so cool about it, that it's not in the conventional arena, conventional venue, but it helps you to see that it's all available out there.
What was the name of the book again?
Kinship with All Life. Yeah. You know, as Buddhists, we often talk about compassion for all beings, working for all beings. But if you look around, mostly what we mean by that is working for us, for other human beings. There's so many other beings out there that all deserve our care and our attention. We may not, and actually, the second half of Kinship with All Life, he tells stories of his encounters with other creatures, with a spider, with a flea, Tommy the flea, with insects, with creatures that human beings have a kind of innate revulsion toward. Ants. There was one story where he had prepared a very nice dinner for himself one night. And then he stepped out for a half hour. And when he came back, ants had covered not just his dinner, but they covered the whole kitchen. It was just solid walls of ants. And first he tried to be very kind. Yeah, real spiritual practice, right? Very kind toward them, compassionate toward them. Didn't do a thing. And then he got really pissed off and very angry with them. And he said, look, I prepared this dinner. This is my dinner. You didn't do a thing to prepare it. I want you out of here, and I'm going to have my dinner. So, and he left. And he came back 10 or 15 minutes later. There wasn't an ant in the kitchen. That's Dharma too. It's not just us two-legged creatures. Oh, we just got a few more minutes. Is there anything else that... Yeah? Okay. Well, thank you very much. I always love to come to CIMC. Great place. And hopefully by next week, Larry will be back in the saddle again.
Finally, if anyone wishes to assist in setting up the room for tomorrow, we will be removing the back three rows of mats and cushions and piling them in the far corner. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.